Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Tens of millions of Americans are struggling with opioid addiction, obesity, chronic diseases, and a myriad of other physical, mental, and behavioral issues. In his new book, The Hacking of the American Mind, The Science Behind the Corporate Takeover of Our Bodies, today's guest, Dr. Robert Lustig, argues that over the last half century, the U.S. and most of the Western world have become more and more sick, unhappy, and broken. Marketing, media, and technology companies are maximizing profits by exploiting our brain physiology and chemistry to conflate pleasure with happiness. Madison Avenue, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and Washington, D.C. have purposely confused the term happiness with the term pleasure. You can buy happiness. It's the American economy. But in the process, we've become unhappy. So what can we do about this? Well, Dr. Lustig says that we can start by acknowledging the problem. How can we ultimately reclaim our health and happiness as individuals and collectively as a society? Dr. Robert Lustig is professor of pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology and a member of the Institute for Health Policy Studies at the University of California, San Francisco. He's also chief science officer of Eat Real, a nonprofit dedicated to reversing childhood obesity and type 2 diabetes. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, Fat Chance, The Bittersweet Truth About Sugar. Dr. Lustig's latest book is The Hacking of the American Mind, The Science Behind the Corporate Takeover of Our Bodies and Our Brains. Hi, Dr. Lustig. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Rose. It's my pleasure. Sorry I'm not in the studio with you. I'm actually on jury duty.
Yes, we just learned about that yesterday. I'm glad we still were able to make the show happen.
Indeed.
Well, Dr. Lustig, it's such an important book at a time when we have such depressing opioid addiction in this country. And so many of us take our phones to bed. We're addicted to our computers. I mean, the list just goes on. What's interesting is you say that over the past 50 years, it's really important to look at how we got here. Why did you focus on what has happened over the past 50 years specifically?
Well, if you go back in American history, the balance between individual rights and corporate rights sort of took a sinusoidal relationship. There were times when one trumped the other, and it always sort of evened out. Let me give you an example. In the 1880s, we had the robber barons. In the 1900s, we had Teddy Roosevelt reigning in the big banks. In the 1920s, we had Teapot Dome and land speculation, which led to the original Great Depression. Then we had, in the 30s, we had Franklin Roosevelt and the WPA and the FDIC and the SEC all coming into being, again, championing individual rights. Then, of course, we had World War II, and then we had communism. And then in the 1960s, we had Rachel Carson with Silent Spring and Ralph Nader and the consumer rights movement. And so there was this balance between the individual and the corporation that sort of struck a relatively even balance over the years. But in 1971, all of that went away. And ever since then, we have been our individual rights have been usurped by corporations through legislation and through the Supreme Court. And the ultimate culmination, of course, was Citizens United. But there were many, many decisions that took place in the 1970s that basically handed our individual freedoms over to corporations for them to be able to market to us with impunity. And the problem is, what's the difference between marketing and propaganda? Well, marketing is using information to espouse your point of view, whereas propaganda is using disinformation to espouse your point of view. In the 1970s, several laws were passed that allowed corporations to say and do anything they wanted. They don't have to prove truth. You have to prove they lied. And that's a pretty tough call and pretty tough sell, especially when the onus is on you to pay for it. So basically, the corporate America got a free pass. And there were several people who were specifically instrumental in that, one being Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, Lewis Powell, who decided many 5-4 decisions in favor of corporations, which basically lost Americans their individual right to freedom. And we are now suffering under the weight of all of what's happened over the last 40 years.
Let's talk about a specific example. Dr. Lustig, you are the author of the New York Times bestseller, Fat Chance, The Bittersweet Sweet Truth About Sugar. And as you say, corporations have engaged in a very specific attempt to market their propaganda. And we'll talk more about the word hack, but black hat hacking involves being hacked to believe that certain things are not true. So, for example,
certain things that are not true are true, right?
So, for example, food is a very, very good example. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about this, because we have a paper trail of communication between the Sugar Association and two Harvard public health scientists. And basically, they exonerated sugar and pointed to saturated fat for so many of the diseases that we're now dealing with today. And you write extensively about this.
Yes, of course. Since, you know, I entered this as an obesity physician, obviously I have a more than a vested interest in what goes on in the food industry. So as you'll remember, back in the 1970s, alcohol stopped being advertised on television. So did tobacco, and that was a good thing. But what did get advertised instead was food, and in particular, soft drinks. In the process, we also had high fructose corn syrup, which was cheaper than sugar, which brought the price of sugar down so they could afford to put more into food. And we also had the low-fat directive. Now, the question is, why did we have a low-fat directive? So back in the 1970s, there was a war going on, a nutritional holy war between the people who said saturated fat was the bad guy and the people who said sugar was the bad guy. And the guy who was leading the charge against sugar was a British physiologist, nutritionist by the name of John Yudkin. And he had correlative data that showed that sugar consumption correlated with virtually all of the chronic metabolic diseases that we know today. That is, diabetes, gout, obesity, cancer. He did not know about, and heart disease, of course. He did not know about dementia at that point. On the other side of the table, we had a guy named Ansel Keys, and people may know his name because of the K-ration. That was a 12,000-calorie little tin box that soldiers carried into battle in World War II. That was the Keys ration. So he was a relatively well-known figure in American nutrition at that point, and he was the one that said saturated fat was the bad guy. Turns out, Keys cherry-picked his data, did faulty statistics, and ultimately implicated saturated fat and buried Yudkin in the process. And the food industry was only too happy to oblige. As it turns out, Keyes and these two Harvard School public health scientists, Fred Stair, the chairman of nutrition, and also Mark Hegstead, his assistant who became head of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, were paid off to the tune of $6,500 in 1965 dollars, which would be about $50,000 today, to produce two articles for the New England Journal of Medicine, exonerating sugar and figuring saturated fat as the bad guy. We believed Keyes, Stair and Hegstead. Yudkin was thrown under the bus. We went low-fat, high-sugar, and that started the spate of chronic metabolic diseases and obesity that we are currently dealing with today, which now threaten to bankrupt not only America, but every developed and developing country under the weight of diabetes.
Dr. Lustig, in your book, you make a pretty interesting statement. I mean, it definitely made me raise my eyebrows. You wrote, "I am a practicing pediatric endocrinologist and obesity research scientist at UCSF. Endocrinology is a profession that has morphed over the past three decades from one that previously generated great joy and satisfaction into one of the unhappiest occupations around. Burnout rates are at 54% of all doctors, but 75% of endocrinologists."
That's right. And the reason is because we take care of obese people who never get thinner and diabetics who never get better. They eschew our admonishments and destroy their bodies and their brains in the process. And for every one patient I take care of, 10 more show up at my doorstep. This is an exercise in unhappiness, if I've ever heard one. One of the main reason for this is the mythology of what causes obesity and what causes diabetes, because everyone assumes, well, obesity is about energy balance, therefore it's about calories in, calories out, therefore it's about diet and exercise, therefore it's about two behaviors, therefore if you're fat, it's your fault, therefore anybody can be adhere to a diet and exercise regimen, therefore don't pick on our calories, go pick on someone else's calories. Now, all of those mantras, which the food industry promulgates uniformly across the board, and that doctors and the NIH and the Institute of Medicine all subscribe to, is based on this concept of calories. That a calorie is a calorie, and it doesn't matter where the calories come from. Our research and many other institutions' research have now shown that this is blatantly false. While calorie is a measure of physics, this is an actual problem regarding biochemistry. And I can prove that a calorie is not a calorie. I mean, I don't know how much time we've got, but I'll give you an example. You eat 160 calories in almonds. How many of those calories do you absorb? Turns out you only absorb 130. What happened to the other 30? The fiber in the almonds forms a gel on the inside of the intestine, prevents their absorption, reduces the rate of absorption so that the liver doesn't receive all of those calories and your blood glucose doesn't go as high. Therefore, your blood insulin doesn't go as high. Therefore, you shunt fewer of those calories to fat. Plus, those 30 calories that didn't get absorbed go further down the intestine, where the intestinal bacteria, the microbiome, will end up chewing up and metabolizing those calories for their purposes, not for yours. In other words, even though you ate them, you didn't get them. So when you consume your calories with fiber, it's like you didn't consume as many calories as you thought. But when you consume them without fiber, that's called processed food, then you absorb all of them all at once, and your liver takes the hit, and you get sicker. So a calorie is not a calorie, because if it comes with fiber, it's not a calorie. So that's just an example of how the marketing forces of the industry have co-opted and hijacked our brains.
There's been a lot of research about sugar. What concerns you about what is happening today and how food companies are marketing their products?
Well, so, of course, when we all went low-fat, we went high sugar, and what happened was the food companies noticed, hey, the more sugar we add, the more people buy. And so this has been a vicious cycle of continued consumption and production and disease. So it has helped the industry's bottom line amazingly. In fact, the food industry went from a 1% gross profit margin back in the early 70s to a 5% gross profit margin today. So they are making money hand over fist, and this is their juggernaut, and they don't want to give this up. The problem is we now have the data that demonstrates that sugar is causative, and I repeat the word causative, for four diseases: fatty liver disease, heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and tooth decay. We have indirect data that sugar and cancer are related and sugar and dementia are related. But we have causative data for four diseases. The problem is the food industry keeps doing it, and the and Congress continues to subsidize sugar in the form of the Farm Bill. Mm. So we are actually subsidizing our own demise.
Today we are speaking with Dr. Robert Lustig. He's professor of pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology and a member of the Institute for Health Policy Studies at the University of California, San Francisco. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller Fat Chance, The Bittersweet Truth About Sugar. His latest book is The Hacking of the American Mind, The Science Behind the Corporate Takeover of Our Bodies and Our Brains. Dr. Lustig will be speaking at the Commonwealth Club on November 9th, 6 o'clock, 110 The Embarcadero in San Francisco. And sorry about the phone line, but Dr. Lustig just got called to jury duty last night. And so he's on a cell phone there. If you'd like to join us, if you have any questions or comments for Dr. Lustig, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. He writes that over the last half century, the United States and most of the Western world have become more and more sick, unhappy, and broken. He says that Wall Street, Silicon Valley, Madison Avenue have purposely confused the term happiness with the term pleasure. You can buy happiness. It's really the entire American economy. But in the process, we've become very unhappy. So what can we do to reclaim our health as individuals and collectively as a society? 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall at kalw.org. Tweet us at yourcallradio. Dr. Lustig, one of the main points you make in the book is that we have really made a mistake between the ways we interpret two of our most important and positive emotions, pleasure and happiness.
Indeed. So these are two emotions that everyone has felt. They may or may not know the difference between them because we have been told that pleasure is happiness. Let me try to define the differences for the audience. There are seven. First, pleasure is short-term. Happiness is long-term. Two, pleasure is visceral. You feel it in your body. Happiness is ethereal. You feel it above the neck. Number three, pleasure is taking. Happiness is giving. Four, pleasure is achieved alone. Happiness is usually achieved in social groups. Number five, pleasure is achievable with substances. Happiness is not achievable with substances. Six, the extremes of pleasure, whether it be substances or behaviors. So substances like cocaine, heroin, nicotine, alcohol, sugar, or behaviors such as shopping, video games, social media, internet, porn, all in the extreme lead to addiction. But there's no such thing as being addicted to too much happiness. And number seven, and the most important and the reason for the book, pleasure is dopamine and happiness is serotonin. Now, these are two different neurotransmitters, two different areas of the brain that make them, two different areas of action in the brain, two different sets of receptors that transduce the signal, two different regulatory pathways. So these are two very different positive emotions. So why do we care? So what? So here's where the neuroscience comes in. Here's why the book is necessary. So it turns out dopamine, the pleasure neurotransmitter, is an excitatory compound. It excites the next neuron. Now, neurons like to be excited. That's why they have receptors in the first place. But they like to be tickled, not bludgeoned. And receptors transduce the signal, but chronic overstimulation of those receptors ultimately leads to neuron cell death. Neurons are fragile. They are easily killed, as we know, because when you stop breathing or, you know, drown, your brain's the first thing to go. It is the thing that is most dependent on oxygen and energy continually being supplied. So chronic overstimulation of neurons leads to neuronal cell death. Now, the postsynaptic neuron, the neuron that has the receptors on it, it knows it's getting bombarded. So it has a plan B. It has a self-defense mechanism. What it does is it downregulates the receptors, the number, so that there's less chance of any given dopamine molecule to interact with the receptor. So what does this mean in human terms? It means you get a hit, you get a rush, receptors go down. Next time you need a bigger hit to get the same rush, and the receptors go down, and then a bigger hit, and a bigger hit, and a bigger hit, until finally you get a huge hit to get nothing. That's called tolerance. And then when the neurons actually do start to die, that's called addiction. Now, serotonin, the happiness neurotransmitter, is not excitatory. It's inhibitory. It does not stimulate the next neuron. It actually puts the next neuron to sleep. So it doesn't downregulate its own receptor. It doesn't need to, because it's not going to kill off the next neuron. So you can't overdose on too much happiness. But there's one thing that downregulates serotonin: dopamine. Hmm. So the more pleasure you seek, the more unhappy you get. And that's the key to this entire puzzle, because we've been told by Madison Avenue, Wall Street, etc., hey, you're unhappy. Buy this product or engage in this behavior, and it will provide you happiness. So you do, and guess what? It doesn't provide happiness. It provides momentary pleasure, but it does not provide long-term contentment. And what it does is it ups your dopamine and saps your serotonin at the same time, making you want it even more. And this is the vicious cycle of addiction and also depression. And the thing is that these things have been engineered into our products. I'll give you an example. Do you use Gmail, Rose?
You know, I just started. I didn't want to use it, but I had to start using it for work. Yes, I do use it now.
I hear you. I didn't want to use it either. So, Gmail. A lot of people use it. It's free, right? Well, have you ever noticed that when you click on the open new messages, that it takes about a second or two for the new messages to populate your screen?
Yes.
You think Google's just slow?
No.
Okay. That is engineered in. That 1 to 2 second delay actually gives you a dopamine surge. The anticipation of what you might find on that screen is actually engineered in on purpose. And we know this because it's been outed by a former employee of the company. Tristan Harris, a former Google exec, had left the company and was on 60 Minutes 8 months ago. It was also on the PBS NewsHour, where he basically outed the company for actually engaging in engineering these addictive behaviors into their products. Hmm. So this is not just me saying this. This is their own words saying this. In addition, there's a book that came out about 3 years ago by an entrepreneur out of Silicon Valley by the name of Nir Eyal, and he described the cycle that these companies take in order to engineer habit-forming and addictive products. The first step is what's known as the trigger, the itch, if you will. Okay, and it has to be an itch that's socially acceptable, like, for instance, your email's going off. Next has to be the action or the scratch, that is checking your emails, and it has to be socially acceptable. Like, you know, scratching your genitalia is not acceptable, but, you know, checking your email currently is. You might need to change that. The next thing, the number three, is variable reward. So it can't be the same reward every time. It has to be different in order to generate that feeling of anticipation and pleasure. Let me give you an example. Rose, do you use your GPS?
Yes.
You keep checking it?
When I'm going somewhere and I don't know where I'm going.
Okay, but do you keep checking it after?
No.
Does it keep changing?
No.
No. So GPSs are actually one of the technologies that actually works that are not addictive, because mm-hmm. it's every time you check it, it's the direction's the same. Okay? On the other hand, you know, what you see on Groupon or what you see on Overstock.com is a whole nother ball game, isn't it? And then finally, number four, the only one the company actually cares about, investment, where you plunk down another $800, you know, for the next iPhone 8 or $1,000 for the iPhone 10. That's what they're interested in. And this is the continued cycle of usage, consumption, and disease that has basically plagued America in the form of its addiction crisis and its depression crisis.
Dr. Lustig, what is this doing to our brains? Because, for example, we post a photo on Facebook, right? And then we click and click. Oh, who's liking it? Who's commenting? How can I interact? Or the other day, I'm actually dealing with some stress right now, so I've been going to restorative yoga classes, and I had to consciously tell myself when I was waiting for the class to start to not pick up my phone and check my email. Leave the phone in your bag, take a seat, and just sit there. But I found myself consciously telling myself not to pick up my phone.
And indeed, you had to consciously tell yourself. That's exactly right. So this is the function of a specific part of your brain. It's behind your forehead, over your eyes, and it's called the prefrontal cortex. In the book, I refer to it as the Jiminy Cricket of your brain. It's the part of your brain that tells you not to do stupid things. Okay? It is the executive function center. It is the inhibition center. And it specifically inhibits that dopamine reward pathway, and it keeps it in check. It also takes information from the stress fear memory pathway, the amygdala and the hippocampus, which are where your fears are stored. And so the prefrontal cortex is pretty darn important in terms of being able to sort of mitigate the vicissitudes of everyday life. But when your prefrontal cortex is fried, basically, Jiminy is squashed, and your reward system goes hog wild. And we have now learned that pleasure plus stress drives addiction, because you disinhibit that reward system, so you end up generating that vicious cycle of downregulation of the receptors. And that's how you enter, going from wanting to needing. That's the cycle of addiction. And on the other side, on the depression side, turns out that because your serotonin levels are going down, as your dopamine is going up, and all of the chronic diseases that we see, like metabolic syndrome, diabetes, etc., also decrease serotonin. They're leading to unhappiness, but stress lowers the serotonin receptor. It's the one thing also that lowers the serotonin receptor. So fewer serotonin molecules, fewer receptors, less signal, and that's clinical depression. So addiction and depression are actually two sides of the same coin. And you can be addicted, or you can be depressed, or you can be addicted and depressed. And it all depends on exactly what is happening to your dopamine, your serotonin, and your cortisol or stress hormone levels. And the problem is that our current pleasure 24/7, 365 society continues to make our dopamine pathway go great guns, our prefrontal cortex basically go into suspended animation, and we find ourselves in deep mental health doo-doo.
Dr. Robert Lustig is author of The Hacking of the American Mind, the science behind the corporate takeover of our bodies and our brains. After the break, we'll continue talking about how Madison Avenue, Silicon Valley, Wall Street have purposely confused the term happiness with the term pleasure. And we'll also talk about how we can reclaim our health and happiness, and as individuals and collectively as a society. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about how an apparel factory challenged the sweatshop industry. The Alta Gracia factory in the Dominican Republic is the only factory in the Global South to pay workers a living wage. The factory boasts high health and safety standards and a legitimate union. So we'll talk about how this happened and how this model can be replicated. This is such an important issue. And then Friday, it's our media roundtable. If you have a show idea or a comment, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation with Dr. Robert Lustig, author of the new book, The Hacking of the American Mind, the science behind the corporate takeover of our bodies and our brains, you can give us a call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. You can tweet us at yourcallradio or leave a comment on our website. And again, sorry about the phone line, but Dr. Lustig got called to jury duty last night, so he's joining us from his cell phone this morning. And let's hear from Charlie in Berkeley. Hi, Charlie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I have to say that I'm addicted to the computer. I mean, it's wrecked my life to the point I'm very dyslexic and ADD, which probably has to do with sugar consumption and something genetic. But I notice when I go to the computer and I'm struggling to do something, after 10 minutes, my brain shuts down. I mean, literally, it feels like the plug was pulled. And then I just sort of drift into music and you know, aimless things on the internet. And I don't know where to get help. I tell my health plan that I need trauma therapy, and they whatever. The other thing I wanted to say is we have to have a carry nations of sugar. Get certain people, women seem to be at the ascendancy now. Go into the supermarket. There are whole aisles that are just dedicated to sugar.
Mm. Yes.
You know, like Carrie Nation went in and smashed the wicker bottles. I mean, there's endless lines of sugar, soda, cookies, breakfast cereal, you name it, ice cream. You know, it's all sugar.
Yeah, and it's strategically placed. Charlie, stay on the line in case you have a follow-up question. Dr. Lustig, first, do you want to comment on Charlie's addiction to his computer?
I hear you, Charlie. I hear you loud and clear, and you are not alone. In fact, this is a huge problem amongst adolescents. And part of the reason is because that whole reward system and that prefrontal cortex are developing during adolescence. And so if you are interfering with that process, which unfortunately the fast images do, and also the sleep deprivation from the blue light of the screens, so that actually increases your cortisol even more. So it makes it a real problem for your prefrontal cortex to be able to do its job. Since you have ADD, we know that that is part of the problem of the prefrontal cortex, that of executive function center. Now, I'm not going to be able to tell you how you should treat your ADD because, number one, I'm not your doctor. Number two, I am not a developmental pediatrician, and I'm not an adult psychiatrist. So I'm not going to be able to do that. However, what I can say is there are medications that can help with focusing. There are ways to train your prefrontal cortex to do better. For instance, mindfulness. So you have you ever taken a mindfulness class?
My respite is I do a lot of meditation, and I've gotten very good at meditation, but there are still big gaps in my day when I'm just sort of lost, you know.
Well, you know, what I can say is if you find yourself sitting down at the computer and being lost, it's time to turn it off and meditate, and you will feel a whole lot better. Meditation, mindfulness, sleep, and exercise are the three ways of improving prefrontal cortical function. And it, Charlie, that sounds like that's where you need to spend your efforts in terms of trying to deal with this problem. Obviously, you can't get rid of your computer. No one can. We've made our society completely dependent on them, so I understand the issue. But this, you know, getting your prefrontal cortex to operate most effectively is in your best interest.
Well, Charlie, thank you for calling and sharing your story, and good luck. We'll continue to do shows about this. Dr. Lustig, since Charlie brought up computer addiction, we've done a lot of shows about adolescence and computers and iPads, and I'm just seeing more and more kids with these devices. And there's
Indeed.
So much new science that tells us how this is affecting their brains.
Right. So the males have video game addiction, and the females have social media addiction. And they're not all that different, ultimately. It's a question of the reward that they get from it. Now, the Facebook like is the most dangerous button on the computer by far and away, because it's not really about like, it's about dislike. And what people are doing is by constantly checking it, they are actually feeding this addiction and actually leading to depression. There are many studies that show that Facebook use is associated with depression. Now, Facebook counters that by saying, well, these are depressed people who are looking for social validation on the computer, and that is not true. We now have the time lag analysis data in real time to demonstrate that no matter where you start in terms of your emotional well-being, 2 weeks of Facebook leads to a diminution in your response to your emotional well-being. In other words, the use of Facebook itself causes the depression, and it's a it's causative, not correlative.
How does using Facebook affect our levels of empathy?
So, empathy. Let's back that up just 1 second. Okay, one of the chapters in the book. There are four methods for dealing with this issue of happiness and contentment. I'll just mention the four of them now. They're called the four C's: connect, contribute, cope, and cook. Now, we've just talked about cope with Charlie. Connect, and that does not mean Facebook. It means interpersonal, face-to-face, eye-to-eye connection, which you cannot achieve over Facebook. Why does it have to be face-to-face, eye-to-eye? Why does it have to be in someone's presence? And the answer is, we have a set of neurons in the back of our head, which are called mirror neurons. And these neurons are reading the facial expressions of the person that you are talking to 24/7 in real time. And you are transducing the signal that the facial expressions of the person you're talking to give to you. And you end up adopting those same emotions that those facial expressions signify. This is a process we call empathy. Now, have you ever heard of the research like Paul Ekman from UC Berkeley, where he went to Papua New Guinea, you know, in a completely different culture that, you know, completely separate from Western society, and they had the exact same facial expressions that we do, obviously that different language, but the facial expressions for happiness, for sadness, for worry, for terror, for anxiety are, you know, worldwide, human-wide, no matter where you go. These are baked in. And so we have these mirror neurons very specifically to read the person that we are talking to. And we adopt those same emotions. And that generates serotonin in the process we call empathy. People who can't generate empathy can't generate any happiness. And we have a name for those people. They're called psychopaths.
Well, I was just going to say, Dr. Lustig, that in addition to all of what you're explaining, we have our current political crisis. I mean, so many people are stressed out
Indeed.
Because of what's happening in Washington.
Indeed.
Add that
well,
to...
Well, we have a psychopath in the White House.
Thank you. And then add that to generational trauma is getting a lot more attention these days. And then racism.
Absolutely.
So there's all of these factors.
Absolutely. So the point is that all of this division that has has occurred has been through the marketing, or I should say the propaganda of trying to disinhibit your prefrontal cortex and let your reward system run rampant. Let me give you an example, and let's then turn that on what's going on in terms of the racial and religious divisions in the country. So we have this thing in society called religion. And have you noticed that we have about 800 to 1,000 different religions? Now, if any of those religions was any better than any other religion, there'd probably only be one. But we have about 800. And that's because religion generates happiness, but it doesn't generate happiness through the religion itself, through the teachings of the religion. It generates the happiness, it generates the serotonin, it generates the emotional well-being through the process of community. And every one of the organized religions have at its center community. And that is where the generation of contentment, emotional well-being, happiness, if you will, all come from, and there are numerous studies that demonstrate that that is the reason why religion works. However, we also have this other phenomenon, which is called zealotry. And it turns out that zealotry is due to dopamine. And the reason we know that is because when we started taking care of Parkinson's disease patients in the 1970s, we started giving them a medicine that increased dopamine called L-DOPA, because Parkinson's is a disease of dopamine neurons in the substantia nigra, a different part of the brain from the reward center. But it raised dopamine levels everywhere. And numerous patients with Parkinson's became compulsive gamblers, religious fanatics, started espousing religious zealotry, got locked up for it. And in fact, there's an entire psychiatric literature on what happens when you overdose your dopamine system with L-DOPA in Parkinson's disease. So the religious zealotry that we have now seen playing out in terms of our current racism issue and our religious exclusion issues are actually an attempt to try to disinhibit our prefrontal cortex and activate our reward system very specifically to get the effect that they want.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Robert Lustig about his new book, The Hacking of the American Mind, The Science Behind the Corporate Takeover of Our Bodies and Brains. Dr. Lustig will be speaking on Thursday, November 9th at 6 o'clock at the Commonwealth Club, 110 The Embarcadero. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show. Hi, Greg. Is Greg there?
Oh, Greg.
Greg, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Hi, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, great. I just wanted to say to Dr. Lustig that I really appreciated his work. I read Fat Chance, and I've been rereading it several times. I have some questions, though. I have multiple health problems, and I'm disabled. In dealing with conventional medicine people down here where I live in Palo Alto, at both Stanford and Palo Alto Medical Foundation, and I just recently saw an endocrinologist about this because I've developed some symptoms that are troubling, very troubling. Anyway, you have to really be unbelievably sick, in my mind, for the people in most conventional medicine to consider it to be metabolic syndrome or insulin resistance or whatever terminology or condition you may find yourself in. It's very frustrating because, like I said, I came away from my appointments feeling that, I would have to really be crawling into their office with extreme symptoms in order for them to really take it seriously. And then I have one other question for you. You mentioned electronics, and I wonder, there's a lot of controversy, I guess, around the whole issue of Wi-Fi and its effect on health and just electronics in general. I don't know if you have any opinions on that with regard to the issues that you're dealing with, which are obesity, etc. But my feeling is that, once again, most people in either medical profession or even in local government or whatever don't take seriously the impacts of the electronics on people's health. And that's it. Thanks again for your work.
Well, let me take the second question first, Greg. There's very poor and not robust at all evidence on electromagnetic radiation and health. There are people who say, well, living near electrical lines can cause leukemia. There are people who say that you putting the cell phone up against your head can cause brain tumors. But when you do the meta-analyses and you look at the hazard risk ratio for that kind of exposure and that kind of medical problem, it hasn't borne fruit. So at this point in time, I'm not ready to be able to state that that in and of itself is a verifiable medical problem. Those kinds of research issues will continue to go on, but I'm not prepared to endorse them at the present time. I'm about the science. Now, with respect to your other issue about the fact that you have to be crawling into a doctor's office before you can get help, part of the reason for this is because so many doctors still believe a calorie is a calorie. So basically, if you're fat, it's your fault. If you have these medical issues that are related to chronic metabolic disease, well, you could just turn them around with diet and exercise, except for one thing. It hasn't worked. It hasn't worked in any study. In fact, if you read the NIH's own website, it says that the effects of diet and exercise seem to be very salutary and minimal at best. And I helped write some of the guidelines on this. So I'm very, very familiar and very aware. The problem is that pretty much across the board, we are consuming 74% of the items in the grocery store today are processed food, which are high sugar, low fiber, and they are driving that phenomenon of insulin resistance. So if you have these health problems, you have to be on a real food diet. And I don't care which real food diet you choose. In fact, I'm not for or against any specific diet. You can choose Atkins, you can choose Ornish, you can choose paleo, you can choose vegan, you can choose traditional Japanese, you can choose any Mediterranean, you can choose any diet you want. Every diet that works have two things in common: low sugar, high fiber. And that's because all diets that work are real food. The diets that don't work are processed food. So if you've got medical problems, that has to be your first goal. And the problem is that doctors don't know how to explain that. They don't know how to teach it. And to be honest with you, most of them at this point don't even understand it.
Why is that, Dr. Lustig? Because this is getting so much more attention now about the fact that doctors don't take nutrition classes in medical school.
Indeed.
So many friends, my mom has been to so many doctors to deal with various issues, and she's never asked, what do you eat, how much do you sleep, and what is your stress level? I mean, those are questions that you think would be the first three, but why not?
And well, if you come to my clinic, they are the first three. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, you know, doctors have never been taught how to prevent disease. They are taught how to treat disease. And the question is, why is that? And why is it that only 27% of all medical schools actually have a nutrition course? The answer is Big Pharma, mm-hmm. because Big Pharma supports the medical schools. And so we are taught how to use drugs. We're taught very well how to use drugs. The problem is you don't use drugs until you're sick. The issue is, you know, so the goal is not to get sick in the first place. You know, I used to do the exact same thing as everybody else did, but then I started doing research and I realized what the real problem was. And I then had to change my practice. And now what I end up doing is actually railing against the guidelines, because the guidelines are, you know, written in such a way as to ignore the fact that we should be dealing with prevention, not treatment of disease.
And the other thing, Dr. Lustig, is you have to really be an advocate for yourself, do a lot of research. And if you go to, say, a naturopathic doctor who does focus on things like stress, cortisol, adrenal glands, your insurance doesn't cover it, and it can cost thousands of dollars.
Well, that can be true. I'm not going to say that that's always true, but it can be true. You know, obviously, look, 5% of doctors are charlatans, okay? But 5% of lawyers are charlatans, 5% of accountants are charlatans, 5% of everybody on the planet are charlatans. And the question is, how do you know when you have a good doctor or not? And that's a very difficult question. And I'm going to be very honest with you. You know, looking it up on health grades is usually not the way to find out. Usually you need to talk with other doctors, because they're your doctor's peers. And that can be very difficult to do and very difficult to get those kinds of answers. So I'm not going to tell you that I have good answers for how best to deal with this issue at the present time, but I do think that medical school curricula need to be altered, given the nutrition revolution that has basically gone on over the last 5 to 10 years, where we've now basically debunked the entire low-fat hypothesis, and people need to, you know, basically learn the new nutrition, and that includes doctors, that includes dentists, and that includes dietitians.
Mm. Dr. Lustig, we have to have you back because we're now getting flooded with so many emails and phone calls.
Happy to come back. Next time in studio.
Yes, definitely in studio. I mean, this is a big question, because you're talking about food, which is huge on its own. But then when you add in Madison Avenue, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, this is really capitalism, purposely confusing the term happiness with the term pleasure. And this is resulting in major health issues. I mean, this opioid crisis every day,
indeed,
it's shocking when you hear these stories and these numbers. So, I mean, we're in such a crisis right now, and unfortunately, we're lacking leadership to truly deal with these issues.
Well, I understand that, and I think I have, you know, shall we say, a line on why these things are happening and why they're happening now. But the issue still remains that, you know, unfortunately, climate for business is such now that corporations basically have impunity. They have, so the corporations have the advantages of corporations, and the individuals within corporations have the advantages of being in corporations, and also they have the advantages of being individuals. So they basically can't be touched. Notice that when we had the economic crisis of 2008, no one went to jail.
Mm. Yep, we've done shows about that.
There's a reason for that. Mm. We need to talk about what's happened and how to alter that, how to alter what's going on in our society so that people do understand the difference between pleasure and happiness. My book, I think, you know, it lays this argument out, and I am very happy to engage in a constructive national discussion on what we should and can do to try to stem the tide of these epidemics. But I will tell you right now, President Trump's Just Say No campaign, it didn't work for Nancy Reagan, and it's not going to work for Donald Trump.
Dr. Robert Lustig is author of The Hacking of the American Mind, The Science Behind the Corporate Takeover of Our Bodies and Brains. He'll be speaking on Thursday, November 9th at the Commonwealth Club, 110 The Embarcadero in San Francisco at 6 o'clock p.m. Dr. Lustig, thank you so much for all of your work. Thanks for joining us, and we'd love to have you back.
Rose, thank you. And anytime you say, I'll be there with bells on in studio.
Great. Look forward to it. Thank you. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to talk about how an apparel factory challenged the sweatshop industry. The Alta Gracia factory in the Dominican Republic is the only factory in the global south to pay workers a living wage. This factory boasts high health and safety standards and a union. The new book, Sewing Hope, tells the story of how workers and labor advocates created a factory committed to treating workers fairly. How can this model be replicated? That is tomorrow. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us.